You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 15th of December 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
Net neutrality is where every piece of data that goes across the internet is treated the same way. So your service provider can't slow down an email or speed up the video connection you have unless you choose a new speed for everything.
Why has the United States Federal Communications Commission decided to meddle with the internet in a way likely to annoy almost everybody? My guests from Monocle's bureaus in Hong Kong, Toronto, and New York will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including what we are probably going to have to get used to calling the Merkel and Macron show, the prospect of Rupert Murdoch with $52 billion to spend, and the possible beginning of the end of high street fashion emporia. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24. Right now. And welcome to the show. My guests today are Ed Stocker from Monocle's Bureau in New York, Thomas Lewis from Toronto, and from our Hong Kong Bureau, James Chambers. Welcome all. We will start with an issue which may well affect all of your jurisdictions and indeed everybody else's. This is this week's decision by the United States Federal Communications Commission to roll back rules ensuring net neutrality, the principle that internet service providers cannot restrict or even block access to certain sites in advancement of their own commercial interests. The repeal of the rule does still have to get through Congress. We will discuss all this in a moment, but first, to explain further what it all means, here is Monocle's technology correspondent, David Phelan.
So, what is the FCC doing today? Well, quite simply, we are restoring the light touch framework that has governed the internet for most of its existence.
I think it is potentially a sea change. It's interesting because this is effectively overturning what Obama brought in only a couple of years ago, and things weren't kind of going off the cliff then.
Ever since the internet was created, it's been organized around basic principles of openness, fairness, and freedom. There are no gatekeepers deciding which sites you get to access. There are no toll roads on the information superhighway.
This is certainly noteworthy. Net neutrality is where every piece of data that goes across the internet is treated the same way. So your service provider can't slow down an email or speed up the video connection you have unless you choose a new speed for everything. It's not selective within that. And now they will be able to.
What's interesting is the tech community is completely divided. Essentially, the internet service providers want to get rid of it. The internet service content providers, think Apple, Amazon, etc., want to keep it. What's fascinating to me, though, is how both of those conglomerates, if you will, those entities, they're starting to, you know, you have your Apples and your Amazons, they're going to get into the internet service provider game, and vice versa. Your AT&Ts, your Comcast getting into the content game. So this seems to be, while they're divided, I'm not quite sure which side they really are on.
So, for example, Comcast, which owns 51% of NBC Universal, which makes programming, obviously, they could say you can have much faster NBC Universal if you want to watch that. But Netflix, that's going to be a lot slower. And suddenly, that would mean that you would probably be watching a lot more NBC Universal because it looks better on your slower net connection. How it will translate is interesting to see, but I think on the face of it, it's not a good thing.
Monocle's David Phelan there. James Chambers, first of all, what does it tell us that apart from internet service providers, almost everyone else appears to think this is a completely terrible idea?
Well, it's never a good thing when you've got most people who come out against something you're doing. But with Trump and Trump's appointees, it seems to be pretty run-of-the-mill. I don't think we quite know what this is going to mean yet for people who use the internet. You know, it's in a way you could see it as a very American thing to allow companies to do whatever they want to do and charge whatever they want, and the market will sort it out. So in a way, you could say it's a very market-oriented decision. But as we just heard, if you do have these companies like AT&T and Comcast deciding to charge different fees to different companies, then you will in a way inspire innovation. You will prompt people like Apple and Google to get involved in the game themselves. So it's obviously not a very good decision for consumers. It's not a very good decision for startups. But, you know, as we've seen with throughout American history, if you do have these gatekeepers who are getting in the way, then they'll come up with another solution.
Ed Stocker, James mentioned there Trump and his appointees to the FCC. If I have read this right, the vote went more or less along party lines. Is this then just another example of an Obama thing being undone just because Obama did it?
I think that's definitely part of the equation. You know, we've seen how Donald Trump has liked to dismantle the legacy of Barack Obama. But I think also, as well as that, and that is an important aspect to bear in mind, you know, Republicans generally, and not just the sort of Trumpian type of Republicans, aren't big fans of market regulation. So one can argue that's kind of in this vein of allowing what they see the market to thrive by removing regulations. They think that eventually this will create a more competitive market. The sort of counter argument to that is that in a lot of areas of the US, there simply aren't enough providers for there to be sufficient competition. So if there were lots of different companies, it could drive down prices, create more innovation. But especially in places like New York, where I live, for example, I have one internet provider on my street or in my area. So that doesn't really
The fact that in New York City there's no competition doesn't sort of make you hold out much hope for it sort of taking root across, you know, rural Mississippi, does it?
I mean, a question for me, though, is that, you know, does this actually inspire competition for, say, new providers to come in, for new companies to be formed? Or does it actually mean that the giants actually get bigger and that actually, at the end of the day, sort of squeezes out those who would supposedly create this wonderful tapestry that consumers then have all the choice in the world? I just don't know the answer, really.
Ed, is it potentially damaging if it goes through? And it does, of course, have to get through Congress, which I suspect is going to become a more and more difficult thing the longer Trump stays in office for anything he wants to accomplish. But if that happens, is it potentially damaging to America's preeminence in modern communications? Might people just choose to go elsewhere?
Well, I think we need to bear in mind as well the fact that prior to 2015, this was the order of the day in the States. So the changes in terms of net neutrality have only been in place for a couple of years and as introduced by Obama. So I think the main issue is really how much, I guess, the big players abuse that power, as it were. If they start carving up things, making it, you know, very difficult for you to get access to, say, a streaming site unless you pay more, and sort of, yeah, try and eke out as much cash as possible as a result of this, then we may see that. But it really depends how the big companies who will be controlling our access to data, how they react and what they do as a result of this move.
And it's worth noting that the chairman of the commission of the FCC, Mr. Ajit Pai, he came from Verizon, so he was a lawyer at Verizon, and they're obviously in favor of this being repealed. So, you know, that does call into question, you know, the decision and why it was made. So it's clearly in their favor.
And big business and politics, you say? What?
Crazy talk, just crazy talk. But let's take a look now at Europe, which has of late mostly been regarded through the prism of the United Kingdom's plans to leave it, but which of course does still have Europe stuff to be getting on with. One effect the UK's departure definitely will be a reorientation of the EU around the relationship between France and Germany, two countries whose history pretty much runs the gamut of neighbourly possibilities. President Emmanuel Macron and Chancellor Angela Merkel have been spending a lot of time together this week, laying out common positions on Eurozone reform, among other things. Thomas, first of all, which of them seems more like the default leader of Europe right now?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I suppose, you know, if you'd asked that question a year ago, then Angela Merkel probably would have been the obvious choice. But, you know, she is a leader who is having her own sort of domestic wobbles, to put it lightly. I think this idea of a partnership is quite an interesting one because, you know, I spend most of my days in Canada, which has a prime minister who most people internationally at least see as a bit of a sort of flag bearer for lots of good things. The picture is slightly different at home. But I think Emmanuel Macron certainly has, you know, a similar kind of image for lots of people around the world. similarly for Angela Merkel, obviously she's been around for so much longer. I think, you know, this idea of a partnership is probably quite an enticing one for lots of people who do have ideas of sort of, you know, a progressive sort of way forward in many sort of areas. And I think, you know, it's quite sort of canny on their part too. They're both obviously very acute political operators in their own way. Macron being very good at the PR game, for example, Angela Merkel being very good at the sort of the nuts and bolts of politics. So I don't know. I think they're quite good to sort of be sort of going hand in hand at this, I guess, because there are so many unknowns going forward as the UK's departure becomes more of a reality.
Now, Ed, do they strike you as two people who in other circumstances, perhaps slightly less fraught circumstances, would have been a natural double act, or are we looking at some sort of odd couple sitcom thrown together by circumstance variety setup?
I think, I mean, slightly, yes. I mean, the Franco German relationship hasn't always been the easiest. They're not always
it's had ups and downs.
They haven't been the most comfortable bedfellows in the past. there's a few elements to this. I think one is that Emmanuel Macron has kind of stepped up and really decided he wants to play the statesman as well, perhaps more than François Hollande did or was willing to do. And I think, obviously, with Brexit and everything else that's been happening in Europe and the Eurozone, there's been a need to show a united front to make sure that other countries don't follow the same way as Britain. And so they've realised that, I think, you know, France and Germany are absolutely vital to the European project, as it were. The EU would fail if those two parties didn't show the sort of unity that they're showing. And so they see it as essential for the continuation. And I think Macron, as we saw in his speech back in September, when he sort of outlined some of the changes that needed to be made, like introducing a finance minister for across the European Union, for example, he's realised that, you know, there are fundamental issues within the European Union, part of the reasons for Brexit, and those need addressing. So I think, you know, France and Macron have stepped up to the game, Merkel too, in the need to sort of show that both Europe is united and there are fundamental changes that need to take place at the heart of it.
James, might the odd couple thing end up kind of working for them? As we have been discussing quite rightly, Macron exhibits an obvious taste for pomp and ceremony and a certain, I think, Napoleonic, if not outright imperial grandeur, whereas, of course, Merkel herself could not appear less interested in any of that.
Yes, that's true. But in a sense, we're not looking at a budding romance here. This is more the end of the affair, because, you know, we've seen these two do the dance before. But as we all know, with Merkel, she's coming towards the end of her term in Germany. If it's not, it certainly won't, maybe won't be this year. But we could be looking at more elections next year, and so she's very much on the way out. Whereas, you know, Macron is the rising star of Europe, and he is the future of the EU. So perhaps it's better to be looking forward to 2018 and talking about who his next partner would be and who he can form another relationship with to drive the EU forward. So it's certain,
you don't think by default that has to be whoever the Chancellor of Germany is?
Historically, yes, of course. And you can't not involve of the Germans. But it doesn't have to be a two-man or one-man, one-woman show. It's not necessarily right that it's the French and the Germans who decide what happens in the EU. You get a lot of people complaining, especially in Eastern Europe, that decisions are made in Berlin and Paris and that before the summits, and then they get, I guess, just told what to do. So certainly you'd hope that you have the Italians and the Spanish getting involved too, but, you know, it should be more inclusive. It shouldn't be these two countries just setting the agenda for the rest of the bloc.
Thomas, do you think it's fair to say that France gives every appearance of seeing Brexit as rather more of an opportunity and less perhaps a matter for regret than Germany does?
Absolutely, I think. I think, you know, Macron has been so quick to launch these initiatives, it seems, to sort of lure people to France from both the United States and from the UK in various sectors, to really sort of take the initiative that, you know, if, say, London, for example, as a financial capital is on the wane, on the way out as Brexit takes force, then why not Paris sort of next as Europe's sort of financial capital? I think, you know, it's about, you know, he's a new leader. He was elected by surprise in sort of many ways. You know, the odds were sort of very much against him. His whole sort of story is kind of taps into this, you know, political mood, I guess, we're in many ways. I think the fact that he's trying to sort of, you know, put meat on the bones of that promise in the Brexit sort of context is quite interesting. And I think to go back to the Trudeau, Justin Trudeau example, I think that's something that he's slightly struggled with since his election in 2015, is that the PR game has been incredibly good and has yielded lots of things for many people across the country. But in terms of actual policy, you know, there are a lot of people who are raising quite serious questions. So I think, you know, the fact that Macron, for example, is going so hard sort of, you know, to sort of reshape France in a post-Brexit way in many ways, you know, could be quite interesting if things actually take, you know, are allowed to sort of, you know, bear fruit.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Miller, along with Thomas Lewis, Ed Stocker and James Chambers. More shortly.
Our very own Monocle Library is growing into a robust collection of well-turned-out titles. For an in-depth look into our core theme of quality of life, why not delve into our first-ever book, The Monocle Guide to Better Living? For any would-be business leaders, entrepreneurs, or even established companies in search of fresh ideas, there's The Monocle Guide to Good Business. In How to Make a Nation, a Monocle Guide, we look at the small and the big things that can help make our nations work better. And in The Monocle Guide to Drinking and Dining, we bypass the foam and the fuss to uncover the makings of a truly great meal. Monocle's handsome books are published by our friends at Gestalten in Berlin and offer a world of new experiences between the covers. So spruce up your shelves today and buy some of our titles online at monocle.com or from any good bookstore.
You're back with Midori House with me, Andrew Miller. Still with me are Ed Stocker, James Chambers and Thomas Lewis. Now, let's look at another seismic media story. We did, of course, start the show with one. But this is this week's announcement that Disney has agreed to spend $52.4 billion US dollars on the acquisition of the entertainment assets of 21st Century Fox, pending the agreement of regulators. Most of the speculation about the deal, to which we shall shortly be adding, has revolved around what Rupert Murdoch will spend this fortune on, now that he appears to have decided to refocus on his first love of newspapers and news. First of all, though, Ed, do we understand why Disney has done this? I mean, Rupert Murdoch has not got to where he is by making repeatedly bad decisions. If he was all of a sudden anxious to sell me something, I might be a bit worried about why.
I mean, it's a good deal for him, isn't it? $52.4 billion. I mean, obviously, they're buying a very successful part of the business. If you look at sort of some of the films that have been produced, like Avatar, you know, the British pay-for channel, Sky, other channels include FX and National Geographic. So a big opportunity, I guess, for Disney to sort of expand its brands, and perhaps a sign that Rupert Murdoch is wanting to sort of slow down slightly, or as you were alluding to before, go back to this, you know, first love, which is, of course, newspapers, which he's still kind of managed to hang on to and come out of despite, you know, the phone hacking scandal in the UK in 2011.
A $50 billion pension pot at the age of 86 would buy you a heck of a retirement, wouldn't it? James, do we understand what Murdoch is doing yet? Is this a scaling down, a withdrawing from, or is this a socking up of cash in order to expand?
As a lot of commentators and analysts have been saying, you know, Rupert Murdoch doesn't sell. You know, since he took over the newspaper that his father gave him, he's just been buying and buying and buying. So everyone's thinking now, well, why the heck is he starting to sell a large chunk of his assets? But if you know, he says he's not retiring. He says he's not done. He's saying he's, you know, collecting a pot of cash to do something else. which makes the whole deal extremely interesting. And if you look at what's gone before this, you know, in 2014, he did try to buy Time Warner, which would have been a huge acquisition, but he got blocked from doing that. And then he's been trying to buy the remaining stake in Sky, which, as Ed referred to, is the British satellite broadcaster. They own 39%. He tried to get the whole lot. It's a very, very profitable, very valuable business. And that's under review. So he couldn't, two times he was blocked from doing what he wanted to do. So maybe it's this case of a bit of frustration. You know, I can't do what I want to do, so I'm going to go elsewhere and use my money and put it somewhere else. As we all know, he is a newspaper man. He has taken out of the deal the thing that he cares about the most, the thing that buys him the most influence, which is Fox News. So I wouldn't be surprised if he uses this cash to kind of double down on his commitment to news. You know, it might not be buying up loads of newspapers. He might pick up a few, but it might be expanding his news empire, which is both alarming and
it is a bit from column A and a bit from column B, because obviously Fox News is what Fox News is. But as you correctly point out, James, he is at heart a newspaperman, and I don't think there's any doubt, Thomas, that his affection for newspapers is a genuine and heartfelt thing. Obviously, he has made a great deal of money from newspapers, but there's some he's run at a loss for many years.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, one of the brands, as Ed mentioned, that's involved in this sale is National Geographic. And I reported from the headquarters in Washington a few months ago for a story for Monocle magazine. And when Fox acquired it in 2015, there were lots of people throwing their hands in the air, being very nervous about, was this the beginning of a kind of a politicization of National Geographic? Would there be some kind of subject areas that wouldn't be now sort of, you know, allowed to be covered? I think most of those fears were allayed pretty much, especially in the Trump era. And they've done some really incredible reporting, both on gender recently this year and also on the science of lying very recently as a direct response to...
Topical.
Yes, well, exactly. And I think there were a lot of people who were sort of, you know, reassured by that. So I wonder if that kind of hands-off side of things, you know, in terms of National Geographic, was this sense actually that, you know, editorial independence is actually quite sort of important to him. I know, you know, we could discuss that for an entire show in terms of the other newspapers he's run and the influence they've had in terms of his own opinions. But I think, you know, at National Geographic, you know, they will be asking questions about what this means, you know, for their future being acquired by Walt Disney. I would be surprised, given that it's a brand that is so storied and is still doing so well in its kind of myriad iterations, you know, whether the questions that came up when Fox acquired it a few years ago, that, you know, whether those questions would be slightly sort of softer now.
But at the end of the day, you know, selling Nat Geo doesn't take anything away from what he really likes doing most, which is influencing politicians and politics. You know, he's still going to be in charge of the Wall Street Journal.
He's kept them all. He's kept all the influencers, and he has the money maker that is Fox News to sort
but
of
just
bankroll him.
A final quick thought on that, Ed, from the perspective of the United States. Does Fox News kind of oversell its own influence? It actually isn't watched by all that many people. It's not like the entire nation is sitting down every evening to watch it.
No, that's the same with all cable news. I mean, it's not actually watched by a huge amount of people. The same goes for CNN. I think it has a sort of outsized amount of influence in the sense that it still manages to sort of get talked about. And often it's other media talking about it. But the president watches a lot of Fox News and gets his news from it. In fact, he gets his information from it. Another point is that arguably Fox News's influence is going down in the sense that it doesn't necessarily represent the new sort of Republican Party, the populist, Donald Trump, Steve Bannon type GOP. It more represents the traditional Republican Party. One could also argue that as, you know, the likes of Breitbart have gone up in the world, Fox News has gone down.
Okay, well, finally tonight, we should look at the startlingly poor results posted by Swedish high street clothier H&M, who announced a 4% drop in sales in the 3 months to the end of November. That still meant sales of about $6 billion, so no need as yet for anyone to soak everything in paraffin and head west under an assumed name. But there is not much mistaking the significance of what H&M says is the cause, i.e. an increasing drift to buying clothes online. This has been echoed in the US. We've seen a lot of stories foreclosures this year by Macy's, Sears, JCPenney. Internet apparently now doing for clothes stores what it did for bookshops. Thomas, first of all, this is me just imposing my own pet theory on the discussion. Is it possibly because more people are realising that high street clothes stores are in the main just absolutely terrible places?
I couldn't possibly comment, given I spend most of my time in sort of very sort of nice artisanal fashion boutiques sort of around the world.
So yeah.
Is that where you got that grey T-shirt?
Yes, it is. More on that later. Oh,
please.
This is radio.
I know, that's why I was describing it, Ed. I'm painting a picture with words.
Don't ruin the magic.
I can assure you, dear listeners, I look great, even if I do say so myself. But I think, look, you know, the fact you look at, say, people don't like going into high street stores, well, the flip side of this, and you know, which is cited in the troubles that, you know, H&M are sort of finding themselves at the moment, is the rise of places like Primark, for example, which is expanding in a very robust way in the United States particularly. And, you know, anyone who's been to a Primark in the UK will know that those places are absolutely, well, kind of, you know, like a living nightmare, frankly, but I mean, they're absolutely
but popular.
So busy, exactly. And, you know, they are expanding. So, I mean, it's not, I don't think it's because people don't like going into sort of physical spaces, because, you know, say the Primark example, but obviously H&M isn't doing something quite right. It's sort of not tapping into whatever the shift in the mood has been and what people are looking
but
for.
To Andrew's point, though, it is, you know, with Primark, it was 20 years ago when we were, you know, maybe growing up in the UK, an awful place, a very dowdy place, but they have been investing in it. And it's changed a lot since the one we remember in our childhoods. What's happened at H&M? They've been focusing on, you know, developing other brands and perhaps taking their eye off their main asset, which is the H&M stores. And if you go past any of them, or a lot of them these days, they are, you know, dreadful places. They don't take care of how they display their clothes. And it's just a large kind of free-for-all to try and scrummage for these really kind of cheap clothing. So it's not a surprise. It often happens when these retailers take their eye off their main asset and the profits fall. They start blaming it on the internet and online sales. But actually what's happened is that they're just not paying enough attention to their business.
Well, some of H&M's other brands, Arket, for example, are actually doing quite well. H&M have prided themselves on being what has become known as fast fashion, though others have been faster, noticeably Zara, which is much more agile. But this idea that you get an idea from concept to shelves very, very quickly, again, imposing my own prejudices, Ed, are people starting to realise that it doesn't really matter all that much?
Well, I think what you said actually about Zara is an important point, that it may label itself as this sort of fast fashion, but it hasn't been quick enough. And so if it's being outpaced by its rivals, it's not going to do as well. To sort of expand on James's point as well, although Arket may be doing okay, if you take your eye off your sort of main brand, then you're going to suffer. And I think the fact that there are other brands out there that have been able to offer sort of good value clothes, but also invest in perhaps what a store looks like more, and which H&M hasn't done so much. You could talk about Primark, you could talk about Uniqlo as well. They sort of create more inviting spaces, arguably, than H&M. So that may be one of the reasons that it's simply not that appealing to go into one of their stores, and it may come across as, dare we say, it's slightly dated.
Because I think, you know, say 10 years ago when I used to sort of shop at H&M quite regularly, they felt like quite...
Before you were at Monocle.
Before I was at Monocle, well, yes. Exactly.
This is now what they're going to be thinking. When we've lost Thomas Lewis, we've lost Britain.
Yes, exactly. You know, they felt like quite sort of, you know, good places to be. It felt like, you know, it was a very accessible price point, but the clothes felt kind of new and they felt kind of nice. And I think it has sort of reversed slightly. You know, I went into one fairly recently and it does feel like a bit of a hodgepodge of sale items here, and, you know, everything's a bit thrown together, and the style seemed to be a bit sort of all over the map. Maybe it's just because I'm sort of an old man now that they're not catering to me anyway. But I think it is kind of surprising that, you know, going into an H&M did feel quite exciting back in the day. Like, it's, say, a Uniqlo, as you say, it sort of does now. It feels like an experience. You're in a place. And, you know, of course, like, say, shopping malls and things, there are countless trouble stories happening all around the world. But I think the people who are doing it right, as Ed says, you know, are creating a space where people want to go to.
And I don't think places like Zara are necessarily safe. I was walking past one of their shops in Hong Kong recently and I thought to myself, that's looked the same for the last 5 to 10 years. They need to start renovating their brand a bit.
And in just a few seconds, Thomas, that grey T-shirt is from?
From Cotton, a Toronto brand, Egyptian cotton. It's great. Other T-shirt brands are available, but yeah, this is great. Well,
good plug. You'll get a reduction now.
If only our listeners could see it. It is a magnificent grey T-shirt. That does bring us to the end of today's show. Thomas Lewis, James Chambers and Ed Stocker, thank you for joining us at Midori House. It was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Tasha Kleeman. Our studio manager was David Stevens. More music next at 1900. It's The Menu with Marcus Hippie. We'll have more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. I'll be your host for that as well. Midori House returns on Monday with a special edition from Zurich. I'm Andrew Muller. Have a great weekend. Thanks for listening.